Today, you know, we're going to continue in the Gospel of Matthew. It's been a wild ride. I've been really enjoying the Gospel of Matthew. Now, if you know where we've been in this book, Dale kind of summed it up, I thought, really, really well, as last week we talked about the Transfiguration, kind of this famous part of the Gospel. And last week I attempted to make it clear that the confrontation right before this moment on the mountain is what informs the vision of God we see on the mountain, the vision of Christ. Right before Jesus takes his disciples up the mountain, Peter argues with Jesus and tells him that the cross is absolutely not the way to victory, but is something that Jesus should be spared from. He tells Jesus that God will be merciful to him, or he wishes this upon him, and that God would spare Jesus from the pain. And interestingly, Jesus doesn't mince words. He says to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan." You know, you got friends like that in your life that you got to say that to sometimes. And he says to him, you're thinking like a mere human. You're not thinking like God. And you know, I just keep taking that in. You know, take that in for a moment. Jesus is saying that it is the devil that whispers to you that life is merely about your gain and about protecting yourself from the pain. He says that that is not the voice of this God. Now, this is crucial because Jesus calls on his disciples to not only believe that the cross is the way, as if it's merely theological doctrine, right? Something to believe in, but he tells them to actually take up their cross and to follow him into this way. Why? I tried to say this last week. Why take up the cross? Because the cross in Rome means revolution. Okay? That is what it means, where God calls us to walk his way, where we exchange the way of getting and gaining the world for God's way of giving and suffering the pain of compassion in order to change the world's way. Now, this really needs to be made crystal clear. The cross is not stated by Jesus here as a way to get into heaven. It is heaven's way of getting into the earth. I think I've made that clear, right? This is the Lord's Prayer in action. The coming of the kingdom of heaven on earth, just as it is in heaven. Turns out heaven's way is a little bit different than ours, right? And yet it's breaking in. And now Peter cannot square this way of heaven, this way of a cross, with the Messiah's crown, right? The king that he was expecting. And as Jesus said, Peter's still thinking in merely human ways. So as I said last week, Jesus stops using words. You know, there's a time in an argument where, okay, I got to stop with the words. And instead, he takes them up the mountain to reveal the truth of reality. And on the mountain, Jesus is transfigured, which means to display who he's always been on the inside to manifest that on the outside. Glory and splendor, light as bright as the sun. And Moses and Elijah are there, which I said are the law and the prophets, pointing to Jesus as the climax of the entire Old Testament story. I tried to show last week that both Moses and Elijah's journeys to Mount Sinai culminate in this moment. After the people of God confuse God's power for his glory and build a golden calf, Moses hears the true glory of God as God announces his personal eternal name, which is Yahweh. And then he describes what that name means. He says, "Yahweh, the Lord, gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. That's in the Old Testament. So I thought there was people saying it was just all violent in there. Then Elijah, after calling down fire from heaven and seeing God's power defeat the false god Baal, sees that it never changed the people's heart. Power didn't change it. And on the same mountain as Moses once stood, the Lord passes by, Yahweh passes by, and he shows him a vision of wind, and he's not in the wind, and of earthquake, and Yahweh's not in the earthquake, and fire, and he's not in the fire. But he's in the small, in the seeming defeat, and in the powerlessness of a whisper. And so Moses and Elijah on the same mountain learn not to confuse power with this God's glory. Now we've heard the word holy, right? You get that word tossed around in religious circles, the word holy. Well, the word holy means different, okay? It means to be different in the way that God is different. And he's showing us how he is different from all other conceptions of gods we've ever had. So different is he that for his people he had to redefine the vision of what a God is and how history moves forward. And he says it's by his passion of compassion and by the seemingly powerless power that's captured in a whisper. And all of this culminating in this man named Jesus. And we heard a voice from heaven break in and say of Jesus, "This is my beloved son. Listen to him." So by witnessing the vision and hearing the voice, Jesus' disciples are learning that through him, heaven has broken in to change them from thinking like mere humans and to begin to think and follow this utterly different kind of God. Make sense? Well, this is where we meet our scene today. Hey, good to see you, buddy. I'm going to do the verses today one little bit at a time and just kind of let the movie unfold. Hopefully that works. Okay? And as they were coming down the mountain, just as we just heard, Jesus commanded them, "Tell no one the vision until the Son of Man is raised from the dead." Notice, Jesus still does not want his disciples to speak about who he is or what they have seen. It's kind of a weird thing. You know, it's a pretty grand vision to not talk about. I'm terrible at keeping secrets. Right? That would have been the worst thing for me. Show me the best vision. Don't tell anybody. Right? Japers. Don't tell anybody. Why? This is because he knows they still don't get it. He says they won't. He actually tells them, "You won't actually get who I am until the cross and the resurrection." Before then, he knows they will continue to misunderstand the kingdom's way as power over others instead of the servant power of suffering love. Think about that. Jesus says you won't get him without the cross and the resurrection. Time and time again, it seems to me that we, just like Jesus' original disciples, have gone back to a vision of God as power defined by us and for our sake instead of the power of the cross. Does anyone else fall into this? Am I the only person here, guys? Like, okay, at least two people are with me, right? But Jesus is saying, listen, we are either on this way of the cross or we're actually in the way of his kingdom. If we cannot understand this, we have twisted the way of God and simply gone back to building a golden calf. If you don't get the cross, he says, don't talk about me because you've screwed it up, okay? Let's keep going. And the disciples asked him, "Then why do the scribes say that first Elijah must come?" He answered, "Elijah does come, and he will restore all things. But I tell you that Elijah has already come." And they did not recognize him, but they did to him whatever they pleased. So also the Son of Man will certainly suffer at their hands. Then the disciples understood that he was speaking to them of John the Baptist. The disciples still do not get it. This doesn't fit their learned theology. You know, you ever have God break into your theology and find out that you're wrong? You know, that's the best thing when you first come out of Bible college and you're convinced you have everything right, and then God bursts in and humbles you, right? You see, these were good Jewish boys, right? They'd been listening. Their teachers had said Elijah must come first. So they're wondering, what on earth is happening? Jesus knows their vision of the story, and so he said Elijah does come to restore all things. But shockingly, he already came, and he wasn't recognized. Kind of a major flub. Now, what's this about? In the prophet Malachi, does anyone ever read the prophet Malachi? Okay, he's a hit in some circles, okay? The final prophet before the New Testament. Okay, in his prophecy, in his prophetic word, the temple had been rebuilt, but the glorious presence of God had not yet come to take up residence within the temple. God had argued with the people as to why this was, saying it was because of their rebellion. But he promised them that he would indeed suddenly come to his temple, and that before the day of his coming, he would send the prophet Elijah to restore the people to allegiance to himself and his ways, okay, the ways of Moses, so that he would not have to come to them in judgment. You can read this just in the first, the last couple of verses of Malachi. And so the hope of the people was that when they were right with God, which you can see the Pharisees were big on this, his presence would finally come amongst them in power once again, and led by the Messiah, Israel's true king, they would rule over the nations. Sounds like a good time. Now, the disciples are trying to figure out how this timeline could possibly fit with the man they know to be the Messiah, Jesus of Nazareth. Now saying he's going to suffer and be seemingly defeated and humiliated by the temple leaders themselves. You see the problems here, right? Jesus is countering them by saying that they read the story as a victory story. That's how they're reading the Old Testament. And they're right. But they read it through human eyes, right? That's his big thing with Peter. You're thinking like a human. Now, they read the story as a victory story through human eyes. And they conveniently left out the part from the prophet Isaiah about this, that the Abraham blessing of the world nation would heal the world by being a suffering servant. Right? That's a pretty easy part to want to leave out. Okay? The people they were called to be and seemingly thought they could conveniently bypass. So while Elijah came to restore them to God and to his ways, their human ways of thinking made him unrecognizable to them. They didn't want to go that way. So Jesus says they did to this Elijah figure what pleased them. And that word, what pleased them, it means their will. They did what their will was to him. And what was it? What did they do to him? Yeah, they shut him up for good. Right? And if they did that to the Messiah's messenger, Jesus' point is, what are they going to do to the Messiah himself? Yeah, then the disciples clued in. John the Baptist was the Elijah to come. Okay, they're starting to piece it together. Let's keep going. And when they came to the crowd, notice this is what follows next. And when they came to the crowd, a man came up to him and kneeling before him said, "Lord, have mercy on my son, For he has seizures and he suffers terribly. For often he falls into the fire and often into the water. And I brought him to your disciples, and they could not heal him. Lord, have mercy on my son. Peter had tried to tell Jesus he could be spared the cost of mercy, the pain of having to bear it. You see, that tells me that Peter gets it. He gets what mercy really is, that mercy costs. This isn't a theological idea. This is the real stuff of the world. Remember, mercy is the action of compassion. And compassion is a heart that is touched by pain. And it reaches out in mercy to touch that pain. To think that God only gives mercy to you and not through you is to walk by the pain and to think that the pain is not your problem. You ever do that? It's the easiest thing in the world to do. But just as a woman did for her daughter previously in the story, if you're thinking about this movie, so this man does for his son. What does he do? He kneels down before the Messiah and seemingly blocks his way. Right? Notice that? Okay? He cries, Lord, have mercy on my son. Now, is this man truly having to block Jesus' way? Does Jesus intend to go around this guy? By this time in the story, I think we get it. Folks, this man is not blocking his way. Mercy is the way. Peter had wanted a different way to be able to sidestep these kinds of real world problems. But that is not the way. The way of Christ does not save us from the personal problems of this world. It makes those problems our own. The Messiah, our God in skin, as we believe, shows us the problems of this world are not in his way. To face them is his way. Until the disciples understand this and are willing to enter the pain, they cannot and will not heal the pain of the world. Do you see that? Now, oddly, seemingly important detail to me is that this child has fallen in fire and water. What a weird thing, right? It's like, okay, what does that have to do with anything? That's great details, but, you know, does it really impact the healing? Think about this. Right after seeing Moses and Elijah, the disciples are confronted with a child that falls into fire and water and that they cannot heal. Anything click in your mind? What is the great act of Moses? What's he famous for? Yes, splitting the sea. So what's its symbol there?
Water.
Water, okay? The water. What's the great act of Elijah? He calls down fire. So what's the symbol? Fire. Think about that. Water and fire. This is the God who has led his son Israel through water and fire, and yet here they are, Still bound by visions of grandeur and self-protection. God saved them from Pharaoh through the water, right? The one who dominates by power. He saved them from the delusions of Baal by fire, the God who asks you to sacrifice your children. And yet, his people still praise and worship power as the power that moves the world forward. And so the world is not healed, and a child is left in the agony of evil's grip. Do you see it? Let's keep reading. And Jesus answered, "Oh, faithless and twisted generation, How long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him here to me. And Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of him, and the boy was healed instantly. A faithless and twisted generation, twisting the way, always finding a way around the problems and the pain when the story was always straightforward. Think about the big biblical story. A God calling his people to enter with him and to partner with him in healing the world's pain. God's people called since Genesis chapter 12 to reverse the curse and to bless the whole world. But instead, repeating the devil's way of wanting to be blessed and to own the world. Right? You can look at my Instagram, hashtag blessed. Okay? The Messiah, God in the flesh, is weary of the twisting of the way. Why? Think about it. Think about what's going on here. Is he just upset about a bunch of ideas? Let me ask you this. How bad do you hurt when your kids hurt? Right? I've told you guys a story about my kid jumping off stuff and how I feel it in my guts. You ever get that? Like there's weird physical attachment. Am I right? It's crazy. So how bad do you hurt when your kids hurt? Right? Would you rather someone hurt you or your kid? If you say your kid, don't say it out loud, okay? Okay, everybody knows there's no parent like that. Okay? What about, maybe you don't have kids, what about if your mom gets hurt? Does that upset you? Yes. Right? People make mom jokes and it upsets people, okay? What about when people hurt just the people that are closest to your heart? Does that hurt you? You say, don't talk about the people I care about that way. Just try and protect your heart when those you carry in your heart are battered, beaten, and betrayed. Can you protect your heart from that? Anybody? Yeah. It touches you, doesn't it? Well, hear this. Every problem is a personal problem to this God, because every person is personal to him. Do you understand? Every single person touches his heart. Now, here in this story is a child, a real little boy, held captive, burned, and waterboarded by the powers of evil and the devil's ways. How can the God of all the earth not be incensed at that? How could he not feel that child's pain? Sure, he could shield himself by saying, oh, it's just the way things are. Nothing can be different. But he would know it's not true. He isn't angry at the generation because of wrong doctrine or because they broke a rule. He is broken because that little boy is broken. And God knows he should be helped and he should be healed and he should be made whole. And so Jesus rebukes the demon, and instantly the boy is healed. Think about that. Folks, the pain of the cross is not Jesus' greatest pain. Right? We wonder, how could he do that? The pain of the cross is not his greatest pain. The book of Hebrews tells us this is actually for the joy set before him he endured the cross. No, the pain of the cross is not his greatest pain. The agony of a child bound, and tortured by evil is the greatest pain to a heart that has no armor to block the pain, no calluses to prevent feeling the touch, no jading to temper the tenderness. You see, this God's heart is totally open to the pain of the world, and so it's totally undone. Do you believe in that God? That is our God, and that is why he goes to the cross. Why? Because no cost, no pain, no humiliation, no degradation, no spit in his face, no flaying of his flesh, no betrayal, and no death is stronger than his utterly open heart of love for this world. Do we still believe in a God like that?
Yes.
He comes to enter this world's pain and to take that pain and to heal it by making that pain his own. There's no other God like this. I promise you that. Let's keep reading. Then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, "Why could we not cast it out?" He said to them, "Because of your little faith. For truly I say to you, if you have faith like a grain of mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move. And nothing will be impossible for you." The disciples were to have done it. They were supposed to help. They were sent to help. But they were impotent. Why? We are often told, or at least I think we tell ourselves, that it's because we do not have enough faith. And that is why things, wonderful things, do not happen. But when we think about this, most typically, we think that it is why we are not healed. Right? Isn't that where your first thought goes? Why am I not healed of this? But this story is not really about us being preserved from the pain, is it? This is a story about why we do not enter or cannot help in the pain of the world. I hope I've made that context painfully clear. Okay? Now, is Jesus saying the disciples should have had larger faith? Notice he says, "You have little faith, but what you should have is mustard seed faith." Right? Is that what it says? He says, "You got little faith. You need faith like a mustard seed," right? Is that what it says? Okay. I thought long and hard about this. Right? I spent an entire day thinking about this. But I could not see how mustard seed faith is the opposite of small faith. Right? If you can figure that conundrum out, you come up here and tell me, okay? It's like, man, don't have small faith, have mustard seed faith. Like, they're all like, that's the same thing. Right? Right? Like, how are these things the opposites? Well, they're not. Some people solve this conundrum by saying that therefore Jesus must mean his disciples, they got no faith at all. And so they believe he's saying to them that if they had even a tiny bit of faith, they could move mountains. Right? So this is another possibility. I don't think that's true either. Because the disciples do have tiny faith. Okay? Why? I mean, Peter just said recently that Jesus is the Messiah. And Jesus acknowledged that this was God breaking into Peter. He says, "The Father has revealed this to you." So he's got to have some kind of faith. Or maybe Jesus was just using fake positive affirmation, right? Okay, but it can't mean that they have no faith. They do have faith. So what's the deal, man? Why is their faith impotent? Are you going to give it a shot, Dylan?
Is it because their small faith would stay small, but a mustard seed is not going to stay small? It's like a proper beginning that grows.
Okay. Hey! Okay, you want to finish this off, my friend? Okay, well, let's see if we match up, okay? So we're asking, like, what is Jesus saying? What does this mean? What's going to move the mountains? Well, if you're thinking of Matthew as a movie, which I think Dylan's trying to do, you know that this is not the first time we've heard of mustard seeds, right? Anyone else thinking of this? It's weird. We get into these theological things, mustard seeds, what, and then we make something up. I'm like, mustard seeds. I know where that's coming from. Jesus had said in the kingdom parables of Matthew 13 that the kingdom of heaven itself comes in mustard seeds, right? Anyone else remember that?
Yeah.
Okay, guys, I need some affirmation here. I'm feeling alone, okay? That's what it is like, he says. The kingdom of heaven's like this. It bursts in through the smallest acts of mercy. And it becomes this world-housing tree. So it seems to me, Jesus is not telling them they need more faith, or even just a bit. He is saying that they still have no idea how the kingdom actually comes. You see, what they got the wrong faith in the wrong thing. This is why they cannot heal the pain. They still think that the powerful, the large, and the mighty make the mountains move. Now, you ask Jesus, how do you move mountains? Like, I'm going to need dynamite and a lot of bulldozers. Right? Right?
No.
How do you move mountains? Okay. We think, you know, we keep thinking that, right? The power, and it comes in various ways, whether it be status, wealth, some type of way to leverage my power, that's what's going to make the world turn, right? That's what's going to move history forward, right? The question is, has it? I don't know about you, but there's been a time or two when I complained about the government. I'm just going to say it, okay? I'm not going to deny it anymore. Sometimes I complain about the government because I think that's what makes the mountains move. Okay? I heard somebody on YouTube, they were complaining about the rich and the powerful, that they're not doing enough. What do they believe? That's what makes the mountains move. Some people even think it's the celebrities. Like, I'm going to be honest, Brad Pitt could do more, okay? It's all these we see as having power that we bitterly complain about because they should make the mountains move. Why won't they help? Surely they have the power, right? And we become hopeless and we despair. And then we comfort ourselves by saying history is just cyclical and we couldn't change things if we tried. After all, even if I could do something, what power do I have? Did someone say nothing? Like, I'm pretty important, okay? Like, yeah, what power do I have? Right? Let me tell you this. What power do we have? You know, I heard of a man recently who was betrayed and had every single valid reason to leave and be justified in ending his marriage. And instead, he stayed and forgave and took the pain and looked the fool for the love of his life. Because he believed in mustard seeds of reconciliation that get down into the pain. And he made it his own. And I wept. And I wondered if I could or would or ever will wield that kind of power. I saw a woman recently who was hiding in plain sight, silenced by her fears, and yet had the courage to stand up and use her own little voice to speak the message of Christmas, to wear her heart on her sleeve instead of inside the armor she had kept for so long, because she believed in mustard seed words, that her tiny voice could make a difference. Instead of fearing the pain, she faced it for the sake of freeing others from their own. And I listened and was moved as God spoke through her with the power of a well-timed word. I heard of a young child tell his father that he knew what the Christmas star in the Bible story meant, and that it meant that hope had come. And I saw his father weep with joy at the mustard seeds of faith in his son. And I saw that tiny child's words punch a hole of hope deep into his father's heart too. And I was awestruck that a child's words can hit a heart harder than the words of the world's most eloquent teachers. And I saw the power of innocence. And I saw people share their hard-earned money with the poor because their heart is even bigger than their bank account. And I was challenged. And I prayed that God would help me have that heart too. And I saw the power of charity. And last week, as we read, we heard a voice from heaven say of Jesus, "This is my son. Listen to him." And we heard him say, "If you have faith like a mustard seed, you will see mountains move, and nothing will be impossible for you." And I wondered, what is going to happen when we truly, passionately believe and live like that is real? You see, the disciples wanted to stay on the mountain. Bright light, clear vision, glory without cost. But Jesus doesn't remain there. He comes down. Down into the crowd. Down into the valley. Down to a father on his knees and a child in chains. This is the way of God. Not escaping the world's pain, but carrying heaven into that pain. One mustard seed, one act of mercy, and one cross-shaped step at a time. And we have to ask ourselves if we will have the courage to follow him on this way. Amen. Let me just pray. You know, God, I got to admit, when you start talking about taking up crosses, I get a little bit uncomfortable. And yet you don't mince words. You tell us that to follow you is to follow you to your cross as we carry our own. And yet, I would think that is a hopeless and fearful end if it were not for you saying to us, "Fear not." And you telling us that you go to the cross, that you go to death, and somehow through death and out the other side. Lord, I want to pray that we would get caught up in this absolutely radicalized vision of the power of the cross and your hope for this real world. That we would be the kingdom come people. That we would believe with you, Father, Son, and Spirit, that your kingdom really can come in this world, on earth, as it is in heaven, if we would yet follow you in your way. Help us to stop thinking like mere humans and to think like you, God. Amen.
Amen.